antiquity consisted largely of theocratically governed states. Behind every ruler was a prophet. We know from the Old Testament, the books of the major and minor prophets, we realize that these esteemed personages were able to stand up in front of the ruler and tell him he was wrong and live through it. There was something about the prophet of old that was sacred in itself. One of the important values involved was the common respect of the governed and the governing for the revelation of the deities of their nations. The Greeks, the Romans, the Persians, the Egyptians, all the Semite peoples were units in which the most important binding factor was a common faith. This common faith sometimes was bounded by racial differentiation. Sometimes it was merely a voluntary political allegiance. The most important factor involved was that in most of the ancient nations, the people had one religion. There was very little creedalism or sectarianism, and such as there was controlled by a very simple code, which was held to be inviolate among all the different groups, cultural and racial. Whenever you travel and go into the precincts of a different faith, you accept it with courtesy and abide by it and make no effort to disrupt it or condemn it. In other words, when you travel from one religious area to another, you leave behind the one you respected and move into one you will respect. There was no problem, as we have it, of feeling it important or mandatory to downgrade somebody else's thinking. You were a visitor in another country. This made you a guest. You were treated properly by your host, and you treated your host with respect. This used to also be carried into private life. In old days, when a stranger of another religion asked for your help or courtesy, you always gave it. There was never a refusal on the basis of creed or sect. You might not intend to obey the principles of the visitor's religion, but you will respect it and honor him for it. This was common practice among the American Indian tribes. Some of these tribes were comparatively small. Others were major nations. But in each of them, the visitor was accepted for his integrities, and there was never an argument over his deities. This type of condition made it much easier for the older nations to develop a moral structure suitable to their needs. Now, the Greeks also realized that temporal strength had an effect upon spiritual integrities. One of the great Greek thinkers observed that laws were like the webs of spiders. They captured the small insects, but the greater ones broke through. The same was true of moral courtesies. The leaders, particularly powerful and ambitious princes, might very well break the rules, the laws, and the covenants of their country in the advancement of personal ambitions. They were reproached immediately by their religious leaders. But it was often impossible, and even in those days, for religion to hold ambition in check. As a result, many leaders went out to their own ways of life, and in almost every instance came to grief. This brought again to the sage a new example. He no longer spoke just of the laws of his tribe or the laws of his gods. He reminded the people many times what happened when they disobeyed these laws, and he was able to prove what occurred when ambitious princes went against the covenants of their peoples. This became a powerful argument in defense of religious principles. Among the first nations that worked with the problem of interreligious understanding was the Roman Empire. Rome extended its domains through many areas and subjugated a great variety of beliefs held by tribes, groups, and even nations. The Greeks, therefore, and the Romans were forced to come into factual relationship with religion. They had to decide for once and for all how they were going to handle a religious diversity. Cicero and Seneca and Julian, Marcus Aurelius, all of these rulers were confronted with interreligious problems. The final answer seemed to be revealed in the Roman Forum, for in the ruins of the Forum today are the shrines and temples of several religions, side by side. Apparently, there was no necessity for downgrading these different faiths. An interesting angle of this, however, was the fact that all of these religions had esoteric schools or teachings. And very often the Roman was initiated into the various mysteries of several of the shrines and temples that stood in the Forum. He might be a follower of Mithras and still be a good Roman with great respect for Jupiter and Juno. He might be an Egyptian, and he might be initiated into Greek rites or other divisions, Persian, and even Oriental. Therefore, in the days when human beings were thoughtful and began to realize the identity of belief, there was very little actual religious persecution unless some group failed to live its own faith. This could produce serious consequences. And the place of the prophets, the sibyls, and the muses, and these various deities in the descent of moral tradition has been pretty well explored, and we have a fair picture of the facts of the matter. We know now that all of these nations had somewhere among them people who were strangely mystical, that actually mysticism was behind practically every religion that arose in the world. Mysticism was an experienced doctrine. The individual had an internal experience of his own, and this experience converted him to a concept of truths. If he was so converted, he might feel impelled to share it with others. The Jewish prophets, as we find them in the Old Testament, were for the most part isolated mystics. They lived in the deserts or in small communities or monastic groups. They depended for their instruction upon an internal enlightenment. Because it was a spiritual experience in themselves, attended by various psychic phenomena, particularly that of internal illumination, these prophets felt entitled to refer to themselves as messengers of God. The message they received came to them in their meditation or in their devotions. Most of these prophets were unworldly persons. They made no pretense to a physical grandeur. They did not work for money. They did not expect fame. They were devout persons dedicated to the revelation of inner certainties that had been bestowed upon them, they believed, by divine intercession. These prophets, going around among the people, very often came into conflict with prevailing customs. But they did not come into conflict with the basic religion of the country where they traveled. The Jewish prophets were in no way in conflict with the Mosaic revelation. What they really were was reminding thoughts or thinkers to bring back these peoples to the faith that they declared they possessed. So a prophet was often a reviver of beliefs. A similar type of revelation and revising took place all through the world. In China, Confucius restored the ancient faiths. Lao Tzu restored the ancient mystical tradition of the Far East. Buddha reformed Brahmanism. Muhammad attempted a reformation of both Christian and Jewish beliefs and doctrines. Zoroaster restored the faith of the ancient Persians. These teachers were restorers and revisers. They brought a more vital statement to their people. Most of them came when the people themselves had drifted away from their spiritual traditions. They came when there was too much commercialism, too much ambition, too little regard for integrities, and as virtue failed, then these prophets came forth. There is a line of this, of course, in the Hindu classics, in which the deity Vishnu is made to say, "When virtue fails upon the earth, I come forth." So wherever the people fell away from principles, the old prophets came forth, and sometimes in anger, sometimes with very gentle persuasion, always reminding the people when they had drifted away from the covenants which brought them security and peace. And incidentally, in old times, there were very few records of these old prophets being badly treated. The people themselves knew the prophets were right. And while they might not be able to live the doctrine, they respected it in those who could. As time went on, of course, the various religions became more or less competitive. An example of this will be found in Alexandria, where the Jewish, Christian, Egyptian, and Greek communities were all within the walls of the one city. But they were broken up into groups and had areas particularly set aside for their own beliefs. For a long time, under the Greek pharaohs, these four different communities of thinkers got along very, very well. The wiser among them shared the common knowledge. There was very little misunderstanding or persecution. It was not until one or two of the groups became more dominantly determined to become the prevailing faith, the competition came in. And within 200 or 300 years of the first dawn of competition, Alexandria was no longer a city of importance. Alexandria was destroyed by contention within itself. It was destroyed when those who believed in peace failed to practice it, when those who believed in brotherhood became enemies, and those who believed in the worship of one God divided that God and parceled out the divine principles in small packages. These difficulties have always existed. Now it would seem that coming down out of the more remote periods of human religious history, that we should have learned a lot. After all, we have buried a number of civilizations of which very little remains except a reminder in history. We have seen great powers rise and fall. We have seen proud rulers attempt to conquer the earth and finally come to what the Egyptians realized, that no man can control more earth than that which is his own tomb. This realization has great interest, and it should have had a lasting effect upon the life of the human being. We have behind us a terrific record of what happens when we do things badly. Now, we are not without our own prophets either, because every occasion where a crisis arises, someone comes forward with rather practical suggestions. We are not without leaders with vision, but we are followers who are not much interested in vision. The world has gradually broken itself into such small segments that we feel comparatively comfortable to injure those who belong to other segments, but will be rather careful to keep happiness with those of the same segment. We are not able anymore to maintain the homogeneity of essential religious belief. And because of this failure, today our problems are multiplying very rapidly. Now, we know, for instance, that in the classical periods, from Plato down to the present time, most philosopher mystics were also rather adroit and rather comprehensive in their social and political thinking. We know also that nearly all of them gained a certain recognition in philosophy or in religion, but nearly all of them were unable to break through the political barrier. As far as politics that were concerned, these issues came too close to the ambitions of private citizens. The average citizen did not want equality. He did not want goods divided equally. He did not want to have only his own share. Practically every private citizen wanted more than his part of the common good. He wanted to dominate. He wanted to compete. He wanted to gradually gain ascendancy and with it temporal power. Most of the religions of the world have not been very basically concerned with temporal power, but nearly all of them ultimately became involved in this quicksand. The original Christianity had no interest in temporal power. Christ stated definitely that his kingdom was not of this world. But in the course of time, physical institutions become more and more powerful, and the spiritual values are more or less ignored. So the prophets of old have left their predictions, as in Isaiah, in Ezekiel, and others, or in the Apocalypse of John, have left certain secret codes or secret beliefs, or have given to the world their vision of tomorrow, the inevitable result of things continuing as they are. If Isaiah was writing today, he would very largely proceed on the basis of our present policies. He would tell us simply and directly what would happen if we kept on doing the things we are doing now. Buddha would have done the same. Muhammad would have done the same. Each one would have brought to us the reminder that when we depart from integrities, we move inevitably into disaster. Now, most people in the quietude of their own thinking believe this. But so many ulterior situations arise that the average person finally comes to a compromise between what he ought to believe and what he does believe. Actually, the real textbook of government has yet to be written. It should be based fully upon human experience. It should set forth the inevitable relationships of cause and effect. It should point out that those who live by the sword perish by the sword. This can be proved beyond any question. This can be scientifically demonstrated without doubt. But it does not, as yet, become part of the accepted traditions of leaderships and political administrations. There is every reason why we need to bring some of these facts into our educational system. And there are two ways of presenting the material. One is to point out logically and reasonably the consequences of breaking the basic rules of life. The other approach should be constructive and simple by simply stating that these rules are the things we should all accept, that they are the basis of our survival. All the way along the line, great nations have fallen. The Medes and the Persians went. Practically every country of antiquity died of its own corruptions. And these corruptions were not especially different from the fallacies and shortcomings of today. We say, from looking back at the Roman Empire, that the Romans ate too much, that the Greeks drank too much, that private citizens gradually became more and more involved in luxury. When someone asked a Greek philosopher to curse someone else who was evil, he said, "What, master, is the worst curse of all?" And the old philosopher replied, "The worst curse is to say to a man, 'May your son live in luxury.'" This is his destruction and his end. Now, we know these things, so we get more luxurious every day. It does not occur to us that these things are true, or perhaps we like to assume that which cannot rationally or logically be demonstrated, namely that each is an exception to the rules. We have a feeling that we are going to be able to accomplish the things we want to accomplish, regardless of whether they are right or wrong. We get back again also to the classical times, and we find that there was always a certain kind of division which had to be accepted. A division between those who had insight and those who lacked the insight. In the Greek, Roman, Egyptian, Persian, and Semitic empires, any young person who wanted to become a public benefactor could receive an appropriate education. If he decided in himself, in his teens or any other time, that he wanted to help the world, he was always encouraged to do so. And today, if a young person has this type of an attitude, he will be talked out of it, if possible. Because people will tell him, if you follow this way of your own choice, you will be poor and forgotten very quickly. But in the days of when philosophy was the ruler of life, these young people were honored by the fact that they wished to make a contribution. It immediately set them aside as a superior person, as one who had dedications beyond the ordinary. And if the individual succeeded in attaining to the initiation into the great rites and became truly a philosopher or an illuminated human being, a sage, he was honored by all who came in contact with him, and a king could not remain seated in his presence. And yet he may have been the son of a farmer. This is a different type of life. It was a life based very largely on a merit system. No one said you had to be a philosopher. No one said you had to live better than the others. But if you did, you were accredited rather than questioned and doubted. Of course, if you received these rites, you were then also the child of the temple. You were set aside in life. And this gave you great privileges, but also great responsibility. If an initiate of the mysteries committed an action that was against the principles of the faith, he was disgraced utterly. No matter how much he had previously been admired, if he ceased to be admirable, this was held more against him than any other thing in life. He might make a mistake in his beliefs. This would be forgiven. But if he failed to live the integrities of his beliefs, these shortcomings would not be forgotten. And what were the basics, the basic ideas that bound these people? Probably the most common and basic idea of all was the belief in a divine power at the source of life, a divine power that could not be corrupted or compromised by man, a divine power that had as its primary purpose the perfection of all that lives, a power which therefore would support all that contributed to progress and would punish all that destroyed progress or interfered with its advancement. The idea was that behind all human attitudes, there was a code that was inflexible and inevitable, that this code could not be broken, and that it was present in all religions. And though variously worded, the code was always the same in principle. Therefore, only those who kept the rules could be kept by the rules. The second principle that would probably become a dominant in the life of this type of person was unworldliness, that the individual must decide within himself where values were. And if these values were in the improvement of his own nature and in the service of his fellow men, then he kept the rules. If these values were to bring profit, physical profit to himself, if they were to increase his dignity, if they fulfilled his ambitions, his egotisms, or his various forms of self-centeredness, then they were wrong. So the prophet was always a simple person, not interested in any physical attachments which might later force him to compromise his principles. He might also be considered to be a champion of world brotherhood. He believed in peace. He believed in friendship between all that lived. He believed in honesty in relationships and practices. He believed in kindness and fidelity. All these beliefs were based upon the sacred revelations of his faith. They were based upon the teachings of the schools to which he belonged. And these same schools were the ones that had the great admiration of all the population. They were respected even if they could not be fully obeyed. The difference between the initiate and the non-initiate, therefore, was the fact that those who entered the temple made a commitment of themselves to a concept or a belief. They assumed responsibility for the control of their own conduct. Those who were not initiated were not faced with this decision, although many who were not in any way associated with mystical institutions chose the same path out of their own integrities. And so it came about that the past has given us a very mottled record of human progress. But at the back, behind all of these different conflicts and confusions, there are these dim but powerful figures of the great teachers, those whom the world will never forget. They come in all nations. They have come in all times in history. But they have stood out for principles and have left behind them institutions of integrities, which, if obeyed, would preserve the honesty and the peace of the world. So we come down now through this procedure out of the dimness of the past, and we find that we have inherited this magnificent vision. And I'm glad to be able to say that in the last few years, a great many basic texts of these older beliefs are now available in paperback for us here. And beliefs that 50 years ago no one was interested in, really, are now becoming of importance to many people. And new organizations and religious groups are arising everywhere for the purpose of trying to bring closer this relationship, which is inevitable if we would survive. Now, this also results in a combination of conditions which was more or less influenced by the Protestant Reformation. In the Protestant Reformation, Christianity was divided. And from this basic division, it's continued to subdivide until we have an excessive sectarianism. A sectarianism which is constantly bringing us troubles as well as expressions of personal individual belief. Sectarianism has resulted in a competitive religious institution that has no foundation in any one basic evaluation which is compatible with all the others. The sectarian groups, therefore, have a tendency to defend their sects. They want to perpetuate their own schools, churches, and beliefs, and in so doing do come into conflict with other groups. This conflict itself was one of the things that the prophets of old raised their voices against. Conflict on matters of religion is bound to be a disaster. It is a disaster to believe that the gods in the sky fought above the cities on the plains in ancient times, or that Minerva, armor-clad, fought in the heavens above the walls of Troy. That the various religions and the deities should become in conflict is a very sad and distinct mistake. Now, why can this happen? Why do we suddenly find ourselves in a world in which so much of our spiritual heritage is simply ignored, that we have no real reason to feel a dependency upon anything of a spiritual nature? That does not mean that there are not devout persons. There are millions of them, and they are very sincere people, and they are trying their best. But too often they have asked for bread and we have given them a stone. We have not recognized the importance of the good people becoming not necessarily better people, but gaining stronger reasons and incentives for the virtues which they possess. There is no reason why every believer in religion should not have a solid foundation in the principles of religion, entirely apart from all sectarian differences. The sectarian differences are unfortunate, but the individual can rise above them. And there is every inducement to. In Christendom, all of these sects combine in the recognition of the New Testament and the ministry of Christ. With this in common, how can there be division? This is a question that has been brought up before religious councils for a long, long time. A faith that in substance is based upon one occurrence in the history of mankind is unable to unite itself in the fulfillment of the will and wisdom of their founder. This is the problem that we face. In this sense, Jesus was not only a great spiritual leader, but he was also a prophet. He was one that brought to the attention of the world the summary of the mistakes of the past and built upon the summation of the virtues of the past. This type of situation does bestow upon us the greatest and the last of the great prophets, the one who is honored now and recognized throughout the world by more than 3 billion human beings. Here is then a leadership more powerful than any in the past, a power of tremendous importance to the survival of mankind. And yet, in some mysterious way, this force is comparatively impotent. This force cannot decide whether we will use nuclear weapons or not. It does not decide and cannot decide what constitutes the difference between the levels of crime. It has no clear way of explaining away the mystery of poverty. It has not the ability to create an enduring civilization. It can preach it, it can teach it, it can emphasize its importance, it can attribute the ideals to its founder and do everything possible, but the world goes along very largely unconditioned. And even those who are nominally part of a faith seemingly have not the courage or the strength or the wisdom to defend it. Therefore, we come now from the prophets of old to the prophet system of the modern world. We find that the same sounding word has two very definite definitions. To the one, the prophet is a symbol of a principle, the principle of identity with good. The other meaning of the word prophet has to do with an inducement, with a kind of compromise which has existed from the beginning. There are certain principles that we will pass over lightly because they are too expensive. We will also pass over them lightly because they interfere with the fulfillment of our own personal ambitions. Wherever a law or a rule inhibits the freedom of the individual to make his own mistakes, there's trouble. And this is one of the problems. We have now a civilization gradually developing which has no respect for law, because the law itself has been so befuddled, has been so compromised, and has been so diluted by personal ambitions and political structures that the average individual no longer respects it. So the one controlling factor of antiquity was the will of God. The great controlling factor in our modern way of life is more or less the ticker tape on Wall Street. The Wall Street ticker tape is now the great revealer of things. I remember as a boy, when I first went to work, that there were little restaurants in lower Manhattan where business people went in for a touch of lunch between sessions. On almost every table was a ticker tape machine. And while you chewed your sandwich, you looked over to see whether you were still in business. Now, also, the ancients never were very much given to the ambitions which affect the average person. From the dawn of time, the public has had to endure the corruptions of a few rich and powerful leaders. But today, the public sees itself now as all composed of rich and compromising leaders. Each one sees himself as the product of an economic system in which wealth is likely or possible. Now, in the last 20 or 25 years, we've been having a bad time with our economic system. We find that it's gradually getting completely out of hand. Well, way back in the time of Croesus, the ancient Greek or Cretan lord, who had his own private treasuries, he took a philosopher one day to show him all the treasures that he had stored away of gold and jewels and beautiful works of art and so forth. And the philosopher said to him, "You have all the gold, but the first man who has better iron will take it all away from you." Now, we ought to realize this, but we don't. That was an old prophet, and his prophecy is applicable to now. And all those who believe that we are going to be able to continue to expand selfishness until each individual has it all is very unreasonable and is subject to inevitable disappointment. There is no way in which we can take care of the moment without some reference to the wisdom of the past. The moment is too clouded. things at the moment are so confused that no one really believes there is an answer. But if we go back a ways, we will find there always was an answer and always will be, but unfortunately we don't like it. It isn't the answer we want. We are concerned primarily with only one thing, the gratification of our own desires. Personal ambition has taken the place of veneration for deity. The individual's personal program of life is going contrary to the laws of living established from the beginning of time. Everything that we are doing today is short-sighted, but we live in a world that has a long future, whether we like it or not. We may try to destroy it, but we will never destroy the great plan, because it will go on. And it is certain that a power great enough to develop and to perfect this universal structure is not going to be outwitted by one little individual who he created or was created by deity who wants to do it badly. It is the story again of the fall of man, and is found in St. Augustine's book on the city of God, in which there are two very definite structures which the ancients recognized, and we recognize, I guess, but we make a different emphasis. According to St. Augustine, the two great cities of the world are the city of God and the city of Babylon. Now, he pointed out, borrowing very largely from Plato, that the city of Babylon was the material confusion of self-centered people, that this Babel or Babylon was the monument to selfishness and arrogance and corruption. And the city of God was the heavenly world, ruled over by the divine power. Now, in our way of life today, we are living in this double situation. The city of God is still here, but we can't see it. The city of Babylon is here for a time, and we see it every minute. As a result of this constant emphasis upon the corruption of the time, we find day by day our moral system is being lowered. Little by little, we are removing the Ten Commandments. We are also destroying the statute of common friendship,